What's new in Azure App Service with Stefan Chekow?
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host. And make sure to check out www.azuredevops.show for past episodes and show notes. And lots of virtual user group speaking is going on. If you have a .NET user group, I, as well as lots of other MVPs, would love to get on your schedule. And so just reach out. Also, if you're tuning in for the first time to this podcast, the Azure DevOps Podcast is for developers shipping software with Microsoft technologies. And the goal is for all development teams to be able to move fast, deliver quality, and run your systems with confidence. And today I have a very, very exciting guest, old longtime friend, Stefan Chekow, is a program manager on the App Services team at Azure. He's worked on the web app cloud offering since its earliest days. And in Azure, Stefan leads a team of program managers who work on the development and deployment of Azure App Service, as well as the development of Microsoft's on-premises and cloud hybrid products like Azure Pack and Azure Stack. So, Stefan, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
Doing great. Good to see you again. So, yeah, no matter what, in these parlous times, we still run into each other, even if it's virtually. So, right, just a few weeks ago, we just rolled off of Ignite. I never thought I'd say it, but I do miss the excitement, actually, of having, right, the expo hall floor and actually seeing just the hordes of people going by and being able to talk to them. I admit I don't miss the 6+ hour flights back and forth and the pileups at the airport. But yeah, there's a lot to be said for just having informal face-to-face chats and interactions with folks. That gets a lot harder these days.
Yeah. And for the people who've never been to a 20,000, 30,000 tech conference, it's definitely an experience.
Yeah, as we always joke, right? I mean, at some of these places, it's like it feels like you could fit an aircraft carrier into the expo hall floor. And even for a lot of us, right, we're always like, what the heck is this, you know, demo booth that someone has sitting on the floor? I think it was, it might have been last year, probably like 50 feet away from us. Somebody had, I think it was like a grain sorting or a seed sorting bin that had
yes,
a whole
with a tractor.
Yeah, exactly. There was the tractor last year, which that was pretty far out. And then, like I said, they had a seed sorting bin that was showing like AI in real time, being able to actually look at the seeds, identify good versus bad, a whole IoT scenario. But for me, I'm just thinking to myself, you know, in a million years, I never expected I'd be standing like, you know, 50 feet away from this monstrous machine. So again, just for the uniqueness value of some of these things, it's always fun just to see what gets set up down there.
Yes, yes. And it was a John Deere tractor. I remember Jeff Holland was given a talk in front of it, and it looked like a big tractor the way it was set up. But being from Texas and anybody around agriculture, that was a small tractor. But, you know, sitting there where it was, you walk by, it's like, whoa, what's that big thing?
Yep, that's true. I believe there were some spirited discussions back and forth on exactly what kind of clothes they wanted Jeff to show when he was standing beside the tractor, which again is sort of funny. That's not usually something that any of us in the tech world would consider high on the list of things to be worrying about when prepping for these conferences. So yeah, well, you know, good times, right?
But yep. It's all good.
So you know, we just got done with, you know, the Ignite announcements just a few weeks ago. Like I said, it's unfortunate that we can't, you know, show the things live in person to bring folks through the paces. But You know, the biggest thing there that we did actually roll out was an overhaul of the entire, you know, hardware line for Azure App Service. And actually, it's good that we're having this, you know, conversation today, because literally it was last evening / late last night that we finally got everything lit up. You know, a couple little hiccups, as there always is along the way, but it is all live. It's there in the portal. It's around the world for everyone to go use. And, you know, it addresses a number of asks that have come up over the years. You know, probably the biggest thing, right, for Windows folks is it brings in the Windows container support that we had in preview for quite a long, long time. And now it actually, you know, makes that live. It's a fully G8 product. And for us, right, I mean, if you've used App Service for a while, or even if you, you know, you read out there, you talk to folks using it, you know, there are a spectrum of apps that just have, you know, dependencies where the, you know, the original App Service, the variant that didn't have containers, where we couldn't run it, right? It's always the classic case. I got to go install something. And it's just reality, right? I mean, apps get built up over time, and then they pull in various installation dependencies, or they expect to touch something specifically in Windows. And in early days for App Service, you know, we intentionally sort of avoided that, figuring like, okay, well, you know, we'll go for simpler apps. But, you know, these days that leaves out a fair number of developer and development scenarios. And so for us, that's really the primary motivation that kicked off all of this quite a few months ago, which was, you know, there is a technology, it's Windows containers, you can run it in a Hyper-V isolation boundary, so it's secure. So it's, you know, you as a customer don't have to have any concerns, we as a platform don't have to have any concerns. And, you know, since it's your container, you can basically go party on what you put into it, just as long as there's a web app we can talk to. So that, you know, we're pretty excited on. We think it'll make it make it more attractive to take some of those workloads that have those sort of dangling dependencies that otherwise you're like, oh boy, like there's no way I'm going to refactor this app,
right?
To go get rid of that PDF writer, as an example. And it's like, guess what? You don't have to. You just, you know, there's a little bit of work. You go Dockerize it. Visual Studio will definitely help you to do that. If you've got the original project, you can build it and go Dockerize it, and then go throw it up on our platform and go run it. And, you know, also what's interesting there is, again, I know this gets sort of more philosophical. There's always the, you know, the, shall we say, arguments, disagreements, and like, container, is a cloud native? Does it have to be on Linux, not on Linux? This is a perfect example of like a container doing what it was originally designed for, right? Which is just to say a way of saying, look, I have a bunch of stuff. I just want to glom it together. And I want to say, here, someone go run it. And have the confidence that I don't have to do anything else after I hand it off.
Right.
So, you know, being able to package everything up, stick it in a registry, go run it, you know, granted, you're probably not going to run an older ASP.NET app and call it a microservice in a Windows container. That would be certainly stretching the definition. But guess what? It is a prime example of how containers can sort of pull things forward, into a cloud-based deployment and do it without you having to refactor, re-architect, or do any other kinds of crazy labor-intensive changes just to get the benefit of moving something up into the cloud.
Well, as we're going in that direction with containers, this is a question that I get so often, and you're designing these solutions. There's this whole container ecosystem out there, and you got Kubernetes and whatnot. And certainly the promise of, oh, I got some stuff tied to COM or some dependency that's just not going to come forward with .NET 5. You know, you're tied to the past, but I don't want to manage a VM with security patches and all that other mess. So what do you think is the go forward, it just works story for a container? Do people need to jump on Kubernetes, or is it just Azure Container Service, or is it something that you guys are working on that's not quite out yet?
Yeah, actually backing up a bit, it would be a matter of the first question is, sort of quoting Shakespeare, to containerize or not to containerize, right? That is the question. And again, you ask 100 people, you're going to get 100 different answers. Certainly there's no point getting into, like, you know, arguments over it. It's, part of it is, if someone is thinking about containerizing, the question would just be like, why? If you're doing it for the reason of just because, that's probably not going to be a great reason. If on the other hand, you're like, hey, the reason why I'm containerizing is because when I put my container in the registry, I can use a third-party offering, for example, that will go out and security scan the container. Because if you think about it, it's now, it's a common format and a representation of your code that somebody else can build, you know, again, something like a security scanner to go run against without having to come up with 18 different file formats that they have to go support, as an example. So if that's sort of your thinking, like, that's why I'm doing it, because I want to leverage that, that's like, great, by all means, containerize your apps. You know, App Service is simply one of a number of different compute offerings there in Azure that support containers. And there's an intentional reason why, you know, if you try us out, if you're running on us, you'll see intentionally there's code and containers. And now again, with the Windows container support, that choice is available for everyone, regardless of whether they want to run on Windows or Linux. And we're intentionally unopinionated about this, right? We're not here to go tell you, you must do containers. We're not here to tell you, you got to go do source code. It's pick what you're comfortable with, pick what your organization is going with. We can support you either way. Now, there is certainly a very valid set of development scenarios where if you are going true microservices, like you really are developing with that mindset, you are truly making small, you know, relatively small compartmentalized pieces of code, and they really are interacting with each other. That's something where, case in point, Kubernetes is going to be the right way to go, right? I mean, I tell this to folks, you know, big and small, whenever I'm meeting them, regardless of organizational size, if you try to create a microservice mesh-like thing on App Service, you're probably going to come to grief. I mean, it's just, admittedly, that's not what we're built for. That's not what we're designed for. And that's something where, again, the various frameworks that are out there that layer on top of Kubernetes, they're purpose-built for that. Now, having it said that, you know, the reality is the vast majority of time when I'm talking to folks, typically, if they're talking about microservices, really in large part what folks are doing is they're taking what would have traditionally been monolithic APIs, where, you know, everything in the kitchen sink right, got jammed into it, and they're beginning to break those apart. With that said, the sharding that's going on, there's still, you still end up with sort of chunky pieces of functionality. It's just, instead of like one gigantic tarball, you know, maybe you end up with 10, 15, 20, you know, somewhat more granular pieces. You know, some folks would call that a microservice. It probably technically doesn't meet the pure definition of it. They're more like, you know, reasonably factored APIs. And that's where, admittedly, you get into a gray area. You know, you'll be able to run them great on App Service. You can certainly go out, containerize them as well, go run them on Kubernetes. I don't know that that's a development scenario, though, where necessarily the trade-off between having to, you know, understand what you're doing with Kubernetes is going to pay off relative to just, hey, I'm running a couple of dozen more finely factored apps. Frankly, that's a place where probably more important than anything else is making sure that from a development standpoint, you know how you're going to do your source code management, right? So where is your code? How are you doing the builds? You know, are you using DevOps? Are you using GitHub? How are you testing regardless? Because again, right, for all of us who've been around, there's no silver bullet. Like, regardless of how you put your code together, if you don't have robust unit testing, functional testing, you're going to make a change somewhere. Like, container isn't going to save you from, whoops, I just blew up a mission critical path on my app, right? So those are places where that's really, frankly, it's not as sexy, but it's a lot more important to keep the investment focus. So do you know how to do the builds? Do you know how to test, you know, and test with confidence? And then when you deploy into production, regardless of what you choose, do you have a way to sort of incrementally roll out a change? Do you have a way to quickly revert a change? And again, App Service has those concepts built in with deployment slots and test in production. If you come at it from a Kubernetes lens, they have ways where, right, you can do namespacing and incrementally roll out and roll back. But really, it's just making sure up front you actually have a strategy. And really, ultimately, with App Service, we're trying to simplify it so that you don't have to spend so much time learning how to do the mechanics of those operations. But again, it's perfectly valid for folks where they're like, hey, I really do need to get my, you know, my arms all the way up to my elbows into sort of the guts of the underlying fabric. And that's where, again, that's that's where a Kubernetes scenario will make more sense than running on app service.
Well, and I encounter so many scenarios where people ask the question, do I need to use containers? And it's a new .NET Core application. It's fairly small. And it's like, well, you could, but you're not actually solving any problem that you have. And so whether or not you guys under the covers accept the deployment and seamlessly stick it in a container and run it for density or not, we just throw the .NET Core app and run it.
Yeah, that's a perfect classic example, right? If you do .NET Core, and again, soon to be .NET, right, .NET branding, 5. .NET development, .NET 5 development, exactly. So, you know, let's say you whip that up in VS Code. If you deploy it onto the Linux side of app service, as an example, you know, underneath the hood, surprise, surprise, we're actually running you in a container, because as a service provider and as a platform provider, containers are a great abstraction underneath the hood to do the metaphorical Lego building blocks and plug everything together. And that's actually another classic example where, again, I know it's a huge gray area in this, but a lot of the technologies that are out there, they make a lot more sense if you happen to be building a platform like we do with app service, whereas sometimes they're a bit too low level and a bit, you know, too much overhead. If you're just like, look, you know, I'm doing development, I have a business problem, can I, you know, iterate on my app and get a move on with life, right? And so with app service, we're trying to say, okay, it's a building block, of course, like literally on Linux, everything's running in a container, even if you're giving us compiled code or just raw source code. But the nice thing is you sitting on, you know, your laptop, you're jamming away on VS Code, you don't have to worry about dragging a container into the mix. You can just quickly iterate on your code, keep on pushing it, and everything just works. You know, probably not surprisingly, I think over time, a lot of the container scenarios will fade more into the background. You know, similar ideas. Let's say you go do a build on GitHub, or again, you do it on DevOps. I think we're tracking towards a point where eventually underneath the hood, the output of that could very well just be a container. Even though you yourself didn't say, hey, I don't have a registry and I didn't create a container. And by the way, here's the tag. We can end up doing that for you automatically underneath the hood. That way, it becomes very easy to have like the history of all the changes you made and actually represent it as a, you know, unary runnable piece of code, aka the container. But in essence, hide it from you unless you have, you know, a compelling reason where like, yeah, I want to go manage registries. Again, right, realize there's going to be a lot of companies where it's like having that registry is a godsend, but there are also a lot of other folks where it's like, dude, it sounds like just sort of mechanics. Can I just like give you the code, get on with my life? If you want to use containers underneath the hood, great, but right, like don't bother me with it.
Right, right. Well, with Ignite and just recent coming out and then the new announcements, tell us more about P3, because this is, I mean, there's only been two other revs of the actual VM configurations underneath app service instances. Yep. So now we got a third. That sounds like a big deal, is it?
Yeah, so for us, it definitely is a big deal. We only get the opportunity to sort of roll over and refresh the underlying VMs that we use every couple of years, just because, right, we're providing an abstraction layer underneath the hood. And so for us, this is the first time in the last few years we've had an opportunity to refresh things. And there are a couple of technical aspects that are interesting, and there are quite a few non-technical aspects, which frankly I think are a lot more interesting. But for the technical aspects, the big thing is the top end of the PV3 line brings in a 32 gigabyte memory option, which is great because we have, for example, .NET folks who run, you know, for example, content management-like workloads where, you know, you can never have enough memory. And so more memory is good. And then again, the classic case is I have more of a line of business style Java application. And again, it can actually make effective use of all that memory. So giving folks that extra headroom is great. It's also underneath the hood, just a more modern piece of hardware. So you'll see on the pricing pages in the portal that this is the first time for us in app service that we're bringing the virtual CPU model. Probably not surprising, because if you've been looking at it from like IaaS or VM scale sets on Azure, that's been there for a few years. So all of these use, you know, the virtual CPU model, but again, they have higher memory densities per core. which for web workloads are great, right? You want, ultimately, it's typically memory, not so much CPU, that you end up getting bound on. So like I said, we rolled that out. It includes the hyper virtualization support underneath the hood, which enabled us to bring in Windows containers. But the SKU is available for everyone, Windows and Linux. You know, you can deploy source code and container-based apps, you know, pick and choose. Again, the intent here is not to force anyone down any specific path. Now, what's interesting about the non-technical aspects is it also gave us an opportunity to work with our business folks to also have what I would call more of a, shall we say, modern pricing structure. And again, if you've used Azure for a while, you're probably very familiar with things like what is a reserved instance offer, what is a dev test offer, right? There are ways to have more cost-effective options for running on Azure. So to give you an idea, right, we have dev test pricing for the new PV3 SKU. And if you go out there to the pricing calculator, it's sort of not the most obvious thing, but all the way at the very, very like super bottom of the page, they have a little, I don't know, slider where you can say, hey, turn on dev test as a pricing option. And typically, I don't have the exact numbers, but it's somewhere like 30 to 50% off. I mean, like it's a pretty it's hefty. Huge. Yeah, I mean, it's like it is a huge discount. We're not talking like 1 or 2 percentage points, certainly not. And so that's there for PV3. It's actually there today. And so again, regardless Windows or Linux, that means your dev teams, your test teams, you know, anyone doing pre-production work, if you've got a subscription set up where it's already been marked as like, hey, this is a dev test subscription, you can go out and just start using the SKU and you will get the reduced pricing on it. So that's great because, again, the intent is to, like I say, have a more modern pricing approach on app service that matches what else you see in Azure. And then also, it's going to come out on November 1st, just because, again, there's like cycles of older systems that have to roll this stuff through. But you'll also have a reserved instance option for PV3. And so that's great because, again, you're talking about 30 to 50% discounts, both for Linux and Windows, if you sign up for either a 1 year or a 3 year reserved instance. Again, there's some amount of, as I jokingly say, quantum mechanics involved. So you do have to sort of read up on the Azure pricing pages, but there's like Azure itself has reserved instance pricing as a concept. We're just sort of clipped into it. But again, for folks who are like, okay, I've got a workload, I'm moving it to production, and you can reasonably look at it and say like, yeah, this is a mission critical app, I'm going to be running it for a year, or it's very mission critical, I'm going to be running it for 3 years. Definitely take a look because you can get very, very deep discounts that will make it much more cost effective to be running on a PaaS platform. And then lastly, this sort of shameless plug, even though I don't know that it necessarily gets in big neon lights in the announcements, but even for the older PV2 SKU, on November 1st, we will be also enabling dev test pricing. So again, we know just given the size of our footprint, a lot of folks are going to be right on sort of older scale units that don't have the PV3 available.
Right.
Or available yet. But again, for your dev test work, you know, for your day-to-day work, take a look, because if you got a subscription and it's already enabled for dev test, you should see a reduction in your PV2 prices at the next bill. And similarly, just looking forward when you're planning things out, really the meta point is dev test, as of November 1st, it's there for PV2, it's there for PV3. Just sort of make it an intrinsic thing of like, you know, for me as a day-to-day developer or for my broader testing, let's make sure this subscription can take advantage of dev test pricing, and you will find it'll be a lot more cost-effective for you on your bill running on app service.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
Unless I'm looking at the announcement information wrong, it looks like P1 V3 is quite a bit more powerful than P1 V2 and cheaper. Am I looking at that wrong?
Yes, that's yeah. So the intent is absolutely P1V3 is quite a bit more powerful than P1V2. And again, I know it gets sort of mind-numbing on how we name these things, but the quote unquote entry level PV3 SKU, it's got two virtual CPUs and 8 gig of RAM, and so loadout wise, it's actually a lot closer to the P2V2. Which itself has two physical, not virtual cores. And I think it's like 7.5 gig of RAM. So, you know, if you take a look at it in the portal, you'll see there's different prices, Windows, Linux. Certainly by the time the reserved instance pricing comes out, what we're hoping is for a lot of folks who sign up for that, they will find P1V3 to be a much better option, both performance and price-wise, than using P1V2. And so the hope is between the reserved instance pricing and, again, dev test, so that upfront you can try it out without worrying about like, oh, my God, am I paying a huge price? Like, no, you've got the reduced dev test pricing, that folks will over time shift more to P1V3 as their starting point, as opposed to a P1V2 or even a P2V2. And probably not surprisingly, the intent is for the V3 line to eventually supplant the V2 SKU.
And we're used to translating these ACU numbers, Azure Compute Unit, like the first one was 210. Yeah, is it now just a flat out, hey, this is two virtual CPUs, and is the ACU stuff going away?
So the ACU stuff doesn't go away, because there still needs to be a way to sort of, you know, express in an admittedly abstract manner what you're getting. But since you mentioned it, the P1V2 has always run on DV2. And as I recall, I think the baseline guarantee you get is 210 ACUs. And there is some option for it, depending upon which way the wind's blowing, that it may end up, turbo boosting or whatever it's called, and go up a couple of more tens of ACUs. On PV3, each virtual CPU is rated at, I believe, 195 ACU. So it has a slightly lower ACU rating versus the physical core. But remember, with the P1V3, you get two virtual CPUs, not a single one. So, you know, again, I know it's a little bit confusing, but if you sort of noodle it over, we have the info there when you're in the price and the SKU configuration page in the portal and look at it. And also, again, from us, from testing, it's like there's no doubt about it. Like, you run on a P1V3, you will be able to run faster and you'll be able to run more sites if that's your inclination than you can on a P1V2, just hands down. I mean, like, there's no doubt about it.
Now, are you guys putting forth an opinion that, given that the P1 has, 3.5 gigs of RAM, where it doesn't make sense to run an app with less than that if that's the entry point?
We're trying intentionally to raise the entry point, the memory loadout for the entry level, because, again, what we do see in reality from all of our telemetry is there's no doubt about it. By far, the biggest problem is going to be memory exhaustion for apps. And again, it's just with the passage of time, Azure has a much more efficient way with the virtual CPU and memory pairing, where they can go 4 gig per virtual CPU, and intentionally at the lower end, with the full size VMs, you're starting out at 8 gig of memory. And again, the intent there is, chances are you either have an app that just needs more memory, or if you're, again, people will frequently run a lot of apps in a single app service plan, they'll run it on a single instance. And this will definitely give you a lot more breathing room, like no doubt about that. So app density matters. And when you talk about that, more memory makes app density a much safer option.
That makes a lot of sense. And just with personal experience, helping some clients put some Blazor server-side apps into production on app service. Yeah, we found that even attempting to run on the P1, it was fine for, you know, just maybe 5 users, but it seemed like it ran the garbage collector a lot just with the amount of memory that's allocated with Blazor.
Yeah, there are a couple of things, right? The old entry-level SKU, which for a lot of folks, they still run it just for cost reasons, is like the S1 and then the B1, the basic one, which is effectively, it's the same hardware underneath the hood, just with a somewhat lighter feature set. These days, I think they have closer to 2 gig of RAM available to them. But I mean, right, we all know as developers, like what these days is not, especially for Windows, admittedly, there's not a whole heck of a lot you can pack in 2 gigs of RAM. And you have to sort of be patient for Windows to swap things around to get to the point that it's actually running your app and not like, you know, whatever the couple of dozen background processes are. It's a little bit more tenable, admittedly, for Linux, just right, given base OS footprint. You don't, that's the problem. You don't get a whole lot of headroom. And that's why for the older SKUs, the next step up was 3.5 gig of RAM, where it's like, finally, you have some breathing room. But to your point, depending upon what your app's doing, depending upon how many apps you have stuffed into the app service plan. And again, like I said, we see that from our own internal diagnostics data. It's not uncommon that developers accidentally get themselves into a bind and it's like, whoops, I'm actually chewing up, you know, the vast amount of memory. And to your point, right, the garbage collectors, memory management, they typically do better when the footprint of the app is comfortably less than the actual available amount of memory because, right, not surprisingly, the OS memory manager doesn't have to work as hard playing, you know, silly pet tricks and like, okay, I'm going to put you in memory. No, I'm going to flush you to swap. Nope, I'm pulling you back in, right? This is better stating the obvious, right? Just keep everything resident in memory and, mm-hmm. you know, just leave it there.
Right, right. So, you talked about the ACUs and the CPU. Can you shed some light on how it is where maybe Application Insights or the CPU will show that an instance has running at 200% CPU?
Yeah, so this is always the question of the unit of measure. It's like some of the metrics will actually take the value multiplied by the number of underlying cores or virtual CPUs. And so you end up with wacky things like, hey, your app's using 400% CPU, which is still a bad thing. But really what's going on is it's basically telling you it's pegging all of the four CPUs underneath the hood. So that's something if you do see a wacky metric like that, I know it's, again, a little bit of a brain teaser, but just keep in mind, like, okay, am I running on an underlying piece of hardware that has probably more than one? You know, it's very simple. It's either one, two, or four. With the PV2, and then these days, I can see it already. We'll have people saying, why am I at 800% CPU with the 2, 4, and 8 virtual CPUs on the PV3? So you will run into that. You will see that. And like I said, we do see some workloads. For example, it's not uncommon folks running functions where they're a much more focused workload doing a specific task, and they can chew up the CPU where they might run into that.
Okay. And then on the reserve instance, which is really cool, just at a casual glance, I was thinking, okay, if I switch to the new V3 for the same and then go reserve instance, that's half price if you put those two together, or somewhere in that ballpark.
Yeah, like I said, there are a couple of ways to slice it. One is if you go like the 3-year reserved instance, the actual, like the discount is somewhere in the ballpark of 50%, just like flat out, just from a dollars and cents perspective. But by the same token, like I said, if let's take a look at the P1 V3, let's try to keep it simple. So two virtual CPUs, 8 gig of RAM. Compare and contrast that to, for example, a P2 V2, that's two physical cores, 7.5 gig of RAM. So those are roughly equivalent. I say roughly because, right, the PV3 has a little more memory. The P2 V2 technically has physical cores. So under certain conditions, it can probably crank more CPU cycles. But in general, what we think pricing-wise is if you look at a P1 V3 versus a P2 V2, you're probably going to be in the same ballpark performance-wise. Now, suddenly I can take a reserved instance and knock down the price of that P1 V3 anywhere from 30 to 50% relative to, for example, that P2 V2. And furthermore, and again, I know it's sort of confusing when we're just talking about it, but the P1 V3 actually sort of sits in between the P1 V2 and the P2 V2. And there's going to be a test in 15 minutes. And yeah, no, I'm joking. But like, this is one of these things where, you know, sort of take a look at it over time and scratch your head. But literally, like the P1 V3 just retail pricing wise, it's a little bit less expensive than a P2 V2. You then layer in a reserved instance and knock down the price, right, 30 to 50%. And that's our whole point. We think, like, once folks sort of admittedly go through the mental gymnastics of like, okay, what does this actually net out to? like, you really should take a serious look and be like, holy cow, I think you're going to be getting performance that at least is as good as a P2 V2. And again, it's going to be 30 to 50% less once you put in a reserved instance price. And like I said a few minutes ago, it's intentional. We're hoping that over time, as we ramp this up, that folks are like, you know, this is a great SKU. I'm going to, at least going forward, start switching to using PV3 instead of PV2.
Well, who would not do it? I'm just thinking of all the different scenarios where even if your scale up rules, you know, take you to some number of instances, but you always come back down to one for, you know, your low times. That one should be a reserved instance, unless you expect to decommission your production environment, at least have one.
Yeah, you actually hit the nail on the head, which is, and again, this is more of a non-technical aspect. It's like, okay, you got this reserved instance, but like, how much do I buy, right? You don't want to overbuy, because then, you know, okay, on one hand, you've paid us, but now it's an underutilized resource. But you hit the nail on the head, which is, What is a reasonable estimate of your base load? Like, what are you still planning to be running on a Saturday or a Sunday, right? And literally, if it's going to be, I'm going to be running one instance, guess what? Start out with that. Mm-hmm. Just say, regardless of whatever I'm doing, I'm going to buy the equivalent of one instance worth of a PV3 at a reserved instance price, because you know you're always going to be running at least that much. And so you'll be able to make 100% benefit of that. And then monitor over time and look at, like, okay, how much am I scaling out? Does it make sense to nudge it up to two or three? But start with one. And that's, again, the great thing about this is you can always come back tomorrow and be like, okay, I have a better understanding of what's going on. Let's actually opt in for a few more reserved instances. But start with one and take it from there.
All right. So let's throw a scenario just so that people know what to do. And see if it throws a wrench in it. Let's say someone has one instance of P1 V2 for off times and baseline, but they have certain events where it's like, okay, we know we scale up preemptively for these types of events, and they scale up number of instances, but they also preemptively scale up to maybe P2 V3. Is that all baked into the reserve instance pricing? Temporary scale ups?
So the deal is, you can absolutely do what you just said. However, the way the reserved instance pricing works is, when you sign up, you say, for a given SKU, I am going to sign up for a 1 year or a 3 year commitment multiplied by basically however many instances of that SKU you want. So let's keep it simple and say you're buying, regardless of 1 year reserved instance. What you would do is, the minimum unit of measure you're going to get away with is buying a single PV3, which in your case, let's say you wanted a P2 V3. So you'd go into the reserved instance UX in the portal and you'd say, yes, I'm going to prepay the 1 year reserved instance price for a single P2 V3. At that point, what will happen is, underneath the hood, whenever you're running on that P2 V3 and we're emitting meters, in essence, those are going to get matched against the reserved instance credits that you've now accrued. And so this is the challenge, right? If it turns out that you're not running on PV3, like if you literally are micro-optimizing, you're saying, okay, I'm actually going to go all the way down to a PV2 on Saturday and Sunday. Well, you didn't buy reserved instance price for that. Right. So your credits are lying idle. Now, by the same token, let's say Monday through Friday, you suddenly switch over and you're running on PV3. And let's say you're running on more than a single instance. Let's say you're running on two of them. That's fine, because again, every month, in essence, you put into the bank, as it were, the equivalent of this P2 V3. And you said, I already prepaid it. And so as you're running, we're basically saying, for the first, you know, 730 hours worth, as it were, of a P2 V3 price, we're actually matching it to the credit. And we're saying, okay, you already paid us. So it all nets out, and then nothing shows up in your bill for that month.
That's even better.
Yes.
Because 6 months through the year, if I've used up all of the credit, and if I go to P3 V3, because it sounds like V3 is the SKU, regardless of one, two, or three.
Yep.
6 months into the year, you use up all of your stuff. Can we re-up?
So the thing is, with the reserved instance stuff, it goes month by month.
Yeah.
So I don't think you can like forward pay a year and then burn it in a month. It's like there's so much in January and so much in February and March and April and May.
But even if I have this big cycle and I know how much I use in a given month, if it's just using credits as opposed to, you know, the trough of the scale out curve, that's even better.
Yeah. So that's the thing. What I expect is over time, as folks get familiar with it, it's to what you said earlier, which is, you know, you can go out and buy enough to just match the trough, or you can say, hey, over the course of a month with my yo-yoing up and down, I know that if I average that out over, you know, 30 days or so, you know, slash 730 hours, that actually I need to buy a second instance worth of reserved instances. You can do that. And just like I said, behind the scenes, it's just, we're just constantly emitting this meter and saying, how many cumulative hours did you use? And if you've already banked it, you know, with a specific variant of the SKU, we're just going to match it to what you already banked, and we'll just burn it up. So yeah, it is, like I said, it's a little bit of financial quantum mechanics to try it out. And that's why I try it with a single instance first, just to get comfortable. But certainly for, you know, instance two and beyond, you do a little bit of math, but yeah, you can build up a nice monthly credit and you can basically sponge up those spikes. But again, you know, to be fully transparent, like, don't, I mean, even though it would be nice, but please don't do it. Don't like overspend on the reserved instance, because I also don't want any of you to be in the position where like, oh crap, I went out and right. like bought way too much and I'm not using it. Start with one, like do it like anything else with scaling in Azure. Start simple, start with a baseline, monitor, tune it and adjust, rinse and repeat, right? I mean, that's how you do anything these days in the cloud.
Right. Wow. This is good stuff. And I can't wait for what, 3 weeks from now. It's coming up.
So like I said, November 1st is when the backend systems with the reserved instance pricing are all going to be online. And then when you go into basically it's not our part of the portal, but the Azure pricing portal, you'll be able to sign up and you'll see that our SKUs will be there in the list of options that you can choose. And like I said, 1 year, 3 year RI options, and it'll be there for all three variants of the PV3 SKU.
Awesome. Fantastic. And that's going to be a big release. That's the .NET 5 date as well, I believe.
Yeah, I was going to say November is, November is a busy month across a lot of dimensions, certainly here in Azure, and as well as with .NET. It is absolutely, yeah, it's a busy month.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, this is awesome. Hey, Stefan, thanks so much for sharing this information. We probably could have dove into all kinds of stuff for another hour. But maybe we'll have to do that too.
Yep. All right. Cool. No, it's great chatting with you, and thank you everyone for who's listening in.
Awesome. We'll include the URLs to the pricing pages and V3 in the show notes so everybody can know where that is, but it's an easy internet search as well. So.
All right.
Well, thanks for coming on the show, and listeners, until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.